TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Michael Parenti, Fascism, the False Revolution, Part 2, from the TUC Radio Archives. The overwhelming response from those who heard Part 1 of this program was disbelief. How can an analysis of fascism made in 1995 be so relevant in 2025? This rebroadcast is part of a very popular and ever-expanding series on what Parenti called real history, a different and intriguing reading of a large number of all too familiar stories. The talk, Fascism, the False Revolution, was recorded before a standing room audience of 1,200 in Berkeley, California. Parenti grew up in a working-class Italian part of New York City and earned a PhD in political science from Yale. In part one of this talk, Parenti gave a history lesson about the origins of fascism in Italy and Germany. He pointed out very interesting similarities of fascism over time and place. Fascist movements made appeals to working people and middle class at a time when their standard of living was going down, promising them relief, jobs, and better pay. The rising unionization and civil rights movements in both countries, Italy and Germany, were partly derailed by presenting an internal enemy, scapegoating of low-wage immigrants and ethnic groups living inside the country, foremost Jews. Parenti makes clear that fascism could not have succeeded in Italy or Germany had it not had the financial backing of corporate leaders. And Parenti expands that inquiry. Yes, it is important to know who supported the emerging fascists. But once they gained state power, who do the fascists support? And the answer to that question shows where the real loyalty lies. In Italy and Germany, the fascists enacted laws and regulations that benefited the rich, cutting their taxes, privatization, giving access to public lands, abolishing labor and environmental protection, reducing union power, etc. As a result, from 1935 to 43, net income of German corporate leaders rose by 46%, while wages went down by up to 50%. In Germany and Italy, the hopes of the working poor and the middle classes to better their standing when they voted for the fascists were squashed. Not only were they worse off in regard to wages and workplace protection, they realized that they had also lost their democratic rights to organize and act on their own behalf. Here's the conclusion of Michael Parenti, Fascism, the False Revolution.
One of the things conveniently overlooked by mainstream scholar propagandists is the way that Western capitalist states have tolerated and cooperated with fascism. Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain, as you know, was positively cozy. He and many of his class saw Hitler as a bulwark against communism in Germany, and they saw Nazi Germany as a bulwark against communism in Europe. After World War II, the Western capitalist allies did little to eradicate fascism from Italy or Germany, except for the Nuremberg trials. But the police, the courts, the military, security agencies, the bureaucracy have remained largely staffed by those who had served the former Nazi regimes or their ideological recruits. And that remains true to this day. I mean, how do you murder 6 million Jews, 250,000 gypsies, several million Ukrainians, Russians, Poles, and others, and thousands of homosexuals, and get away with it? Unless the only way you get away with it is that the very people who are supposed to look into these crimes were themselves complicit. What happened to the U.S. businesses that collaborated with fascism? Corporations like DuPont, Ford, General Motors, ITT, they own factories in these enemy countries that produce fuel, tanks, and planes that wreak havoc on Allied forces during World War II. And after the war, instead of being prosecuted for treason, ITT collected $27 million from the U.S. government for war damages inflicted on its German plants by Allied bombings. General Motors collected $33 million. Pilots were given instructions not to hit certain factories. The devastation of Cologne. There were several factories owned by ITT and Chrysler that after a while the German people learned to go in there and use them for air raid shelters because they wouldn't get hit by the American pilots because they were owned by the American corporate interests. Since the war, U.S. leaders have done their part in keeping Italian fascism alive, giving millions of dollars to right-wing organizations and neo-fascist organizations in Italy. In 1975, Secretary of State Henry Kissinger met with the Italian fascist leader Giorgio Almirante in Washington to discuss what alternatives might be considered should the Italian communists win the election and take control of the government. Over the years, fascist terror groups have engaged in assassinations and bombings in any number of Western European countries to destabilize the existing democracies, what's called the strategy of tension. While the U.S. press focused on the Red Brigades, some Italian newspapers pointed out that most of the killings and the other acts of violence were perpetrated by fascist groups, most of which were shown a generous tolerance by the police. As you all know, a coalition of neo-fascist and separatist groups headed by media tycoon Silvio Berlusconi won the 1994 elections in Italy. Their platform, a single tax rate for rich and poor alike, school vouchers, a stripping away of the welfare state, the introduction of private retirement accounts, and of course, the privatization of just about everything. Ladies and gentlemen, the Italian neo-fascists are learning from the American reactionaries how to achieve fascism's goals under democratic forms with democratic facades. You use an upbeat Reagan-esque optimism. You convince people that government is the enemy, especially its social democracy aspects. At the same time, you strengthen the repressive capacities of the state. You instigate resentments against the newly arrived immigrants, that's going on in Italy right now, and you preach the imaginary virtues of the free market. So we might do well to stop thinking of fascism as a simple either-or condition. The political system of any one country encompasses a variety of seemingly incongruous institutional practices. I mean, to insist that you don't have fascism until every vestige of constitutional government is destroyed and the jackboot is right on our necks is to really overlook the very disturbingly anti-democratic manifestations inherent in many states that call themselves democracies, especially in their dealings with left dissenters. You know, the political center is always described as kind of the moderate place between the extremes of left and right, and fighting a war on two fronts against right and left. A closer reading of history should tell us that the center is more inclined to make common cause with the right against the left. And this is because the center and the right share a commitment to corporate capitalism and the free market mythology. Throughout the Weimar Republic, Franz Neumann, he wrote, I quote, "Every law aimed supposedly against both communists and Nazis was invariably enforced against the entire left, but rarely against anyone on the right." Unquote. Well, I'm paraphrasing. This is Neumann actually going on his thought. Those leftists who were critical of the illegal rearmament of Germany during the Weimar found themselves charged and tried for treason, while rightist assassins and pushists were, quote, either not prosecuted at all or dealt with lightly. Now, this double standard of the centrist state in dealing with the left and right, I would say, continues to this day in the United States and most other Western capitalist nations. I mean, consider how, for generations, how gently the murderous, lynching Knight Riders, the Ku Klux Klan, was treated by federal authorities in this country. Compare that to the way the Black Panthers were treated. Consider how the right is investigated compared to the left. when the Center for Cuban Studies in New York was bombed by a right-wing Cuban group, which boasted, admitted they did the act, the FBI didn't have a clue, couldn't find them. Just a couple of weeks ago, I got a call from the FBI myself. The guy says, "I'm not making this up." They said, "Mr. Parenti, we'd like to come and see you because we have a charge here that you may be the Unabomber." They said, "Sir, could we come and talk to you?" I said, "I wouldn't miss this for the world." I'm not going to go any further. You'll see the movie. The way the mainstream shades off into the fascist right can be seen quite clearly in the Republican Party. The GOP agenda today is really not much different from the kind pushed by Mussolini and Hitler. It's fascism without the swastika. It's fascism in a pinstripe suit. First, break the labor unions, depress wages, impose a rightist ideological monopoly over the media. The rest of the GOP agenda, as you know, eliminate cultural dissidents in the arts, attack the rights of women and gays, abolish taxes for the big corporations and the rich, eliminate government regulations designed for worker and consumer safety and environmental protection, privatize and plunder public lands and enterprises, wipe out public services, and cloak this whole reactionary agenda in a kind of a revolutionary sound. You know, Newt Gingrich, we're talking about the GOP revolution. We got a revolution going here in Congress. Some revolution. It's the same old reactionary class agenda. And today in the United States, we witness some middle-class Americans, like the middle-class Germans of yore, beset by real economic difficulties. They really are facing economic injustices, real ones, and they're turning their anger toward irrelevant or imaginary foes: the immigrants, the Jews, the poor, the welfare mothers, people of color, feminists, gays, atheists, and others. There's something else I think that's happened that explains the speed up of reactionism in America today, and that is the fact that for years, the United States leaders and political and economic elites saw themselves in mortal combat with communism for the allegiance of peoples at home and abroad. The argument was made that U.S. workers enjoyed a higher standard of living than their counterparts who lived under communism. It was a very conscious thing. Civil rights, too, the same thing. If we got to compete with the communists for all these third world countries, people of color, we got to clean up our act, get rid of Jim Crow, segregation, all that sort of thing. That was always a theme. Our workers earn more. Our workers live better than anybody under communism. You live better. Stick with capitalism. Free enterprise is the best for you. And that was a conscious thing. The pressure of being in competition with an anti-capitalist alternative system set limits on how thoroughly the higher circles dared to mistreat the working populace. I mean, I don't want to overstate that. I mean, long before the collapse of communism, they tried to break unions, they tried to depress wages, they tried to do all these things. But now, I mean, they're pulling out the stops, they're dropping all pretenses at capitalism with a human face, you know. And they were always mindful. These people were always mindful of the potential threat of workers getting radicalized. Very much so in the 1930s, very much so in the 60s and even the 70s, and it comes out in their statements and all that. And by the way, of course, that wasn't the only restraining factor. It was also the working class's ability to fight back, to win democratic victories, gains, the eight-hour day, any number of historic victories, Social Security, and various benefits and the like. When the communist nations were overthrown in Eastern Europe, there was much rejoicing among conservative circles. But within a very short time, there was a very interesting, querulous, irritated, irate note that began to appear in some of the conservative publications that I looked at. And it went like this. If in Eastern Europe, they're now moving toward a total free market, why must we here in the United States still have to tolerate these collectivistic, liberalish regulations and restraints that are put upon us? Now is the time to cast off all restraint and sock it to the public. The competition for their hearts and minds are over. There's no competing system to which they might think of turning. There's no need to tolerate any accommodation with those who have to work for a living. There's no reason why masses of people in this country should have a middle-class living standard, why working people should have that, or even so many middle-class people. It's time that these people lower their expectations, work harder, and be satisfied with less. The more they get, the more they'll demand, and we'll end up with a social democracy, or worse. Better to keep them down and hungry with their noses to the grindstone. It's time to return to the good old days. In Against Empire, I call it getting back to 1893. The kind of conditions that prevail in the third world have a weak, unorganized, demoralized mass of people that work for subsistence. You have even below them a large contingent of desperately poor unemployed who help further to depress wages and can often become the object of resentment by the people just above them. And you have a small, insecure middle class that's hanging on by its bleeding fingers. And above that, a very tiny, obscenely rich owning class that has it all.
You're listening to Fascism, the False Revolution. Dr. Michael Parenti spoke to a standing room audience of 1,200 in Berkeley, California, almost 30 years ago, on September 23rd, 1995.
Also, a change in attitude toward the Third World. During the Cold War and the competition with the Soviet Union, the whole option was development. We'll develop these countries, prosperity will come in, give them aid, and middle class will develop, they'll get stabilized, and they will not succumb to the appeals of communism. Well, with the collapse of communism, there's been a shift in policy there too. First of all, they found that policy wasn't working. Third world governments began to close off key sectors of their economy. Yeah, that's the only way you're going to develop it, is to close it off against U.S. capital competition. They were doing things like forming consortiums for better trade deals and better money deals. They were trying to break the global monopoly of Western media. They were looking for more authority over their own seabeds and resources and that sort of thing. And then they were producing goods that were competing with the U.S. market, even at home. So the new policy toward the third world is also a hard line. As with their own working class in the U.S., so with third world nations now. You've got nowhere else to go. You're not going to turn to Moscow now. Moscow's in our pocket. And so, bam, they're hitting them hard. The IMF, the World Bank, GATT, NAFTA, and undermining the sovereignty of third world nations, making an end run around them, directly plundering their markets, and drastically cutting non-military foreign aid to these countries. And in some cases, directly invading them and destroying the government that had any reformist tendencies or was maintaining economic development, as in the case of Iraq, Panama, and in, of course, a dozen reformist revolutionary governments, they've done that. So they don't have to worry about a communist competitor. U.S. leaders are making war against economic nationalism in countries like India, Brazil, Mexico, Iraq, Panama, South Korea, Taiwan, and so forth. There's a lot of people who still don't get it. They don't get it that these guys are playing for keeps, that they are going after you, that they are not going to leave any little bit left for you. There's only one thing that the ruling circles throughout history have ever wanted, and that's everything. There's only one thing they want. All the wealth, the treasures, and the profitable returns. All the choice lands and forests and game and herds and harvests and mineral deposits and precious metals of the earth. All the productive facilities and gainful inventiveness and technologies. All the control positions of the state and other major institutions. All public supports and subsidies, privileges and immunities. All the protections of the law and none of its constraints. All the services and comforts and luxuries and advantages of civil society with none of the taxes and none of the costs. Every ruling class in history has wanted only this, all the rewards and none of the burdens. Their operational code is, we have a lot, we can get more, we want it all. And if you don't know that, you're in a sad place. If you know that and you don't know anything else, you know more than if you know everything else and you don't know that. In the final analysis, the danger of fascism comes not from skinheads or the militia or the Christian right fanatics, but it comes from the ongoing practices of the national security state and its various enforcement agencies. It comes from the boardrooms of corporate America. But before we pronounce ourselves doomed, keep in mind that at the present time, right in these days now, there are people who are demonstrating and getting arrested and raising hell to protect the environment and the forests. There are others who are doing the same at nuclear submarine bases. There are people who are demonstrating for justice and against racism in the judicial system, as the national protests for Mumia Abu-Jamal demonstrate. There are people protesting against nuclear testing in the South Pacific, against Medicare cuts and family assistance cuts, against the suppression of the homeless, against the anti-immigration laws, and for affirmative action. There are large majorities in this country who even support welfare, if you don't call it welfare. If you say, should government help the poor? Should government do more for the poor? It's surprising what people say. We have to get a lot angrier and a lot more determined. They want everything, and everything is at stake. Many people are getting angrier and angrier and increasingly concerned. Our job is to see that they direct their anger at the real perpetrators of their misery and not against the very people who want to make common cause with them. Well, Parenti, what do you have against wealth all the time I hear this talk? I mean, it trickles down, and more wealth, more wealth up there means more down for the rest of us. I just heard that recently by the ruling class propagandist Rush Limbaugh, the best mind on the right. He said, quote, this is pretty high-level stuff for Rush Limbaugh. He said, it's not a zero-sum society. A bigger pie is better for all. No, it is a zero-sum society, because the size of the pie is one thing, how it's sliced is another. If you take a 20-ounce pie, in which I got a 10% slice, and you shrink it down to a 15-ounce pie, and I now get a 70% slice, I like the 15-ounce pie better, at least the plutocrats would. And wealth doesn't trickle down. It is siphoned up from the labor of the many into the pockets of the few. I don't like great concentrations of private wealth because it causes public poverty. Corporate wealth is the greatest single cause of poverty. It is theft and it makes a mockery of democracy. In fact, in every society where you have wealth, you have poverty. That's how you get wealth, by creating poverty. That's how the slave owner could live in such opulence and luxury, by having slaves who work at a bare subsistence and create this for him. That's how the feudal lords could live with their refineries and luxuries and their tables laden and groaning with food, by having serfs and servants working and producing this. And in the societies where you don't have great concentrations of wealth, you generally don't have mass poverty, or very little of it. It's a very interesting correlation. Wealth causes poverty, and that's what I got against wealth. Brothers and sisters, when labor is in retreat, when the power of capital is increasingly untrammeled, all of us are put at risk. The environment, the sacred forests, the beautiful and mysterious creatures of the sea, the ordinary people who with their strength and brains and inventiveness create community and give to life so much that's worthy of our respect. The real burden to society is not the poor, but the corporate rich. We simply can no longer afford them. Conservatives complain whenever we fight back, and whenever we criticize their anti-democratic class privilege, they say we're engaging in class war. I mean, they engage in class war on our heads all the time, every day. Everything they do, every newspaper, every political ploy and move is doing this. Every lie they tell is consciously doing that. The minute we fight back and try to expose it, they say, oh, you're engaging in class war. Well, ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, I believe it is class war. But I also have another name for it. When people unite against the abuses of wealth and privilege, when they activate themselves and militantly attack the hypocrisies and lies of the powers that be, when they fight back and become the active agents of their own destiny, when they withdraw their empowering responses and refuse to toe that line, I have another name for that. I call that democracy. Their first loyalty is to the dollar. Our first loyalty is to democracy and to the well-being of our society and our Mother Earth. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
That was the conclusion of Fascism, the False Revolution by Dr. Michael Parenti. This talk was given to a standing room audience of 1,200 in Berkeley, California, on September 23, 1995. Michael Parenti received his PhD in political science from Yale. He's the author of 23 books and many more articles. His works have been translated into at least 18 languages. Parenti consciously gave up the opportunity for an academic career. He publicly opposed the war in Vietnam, was arrested, and lost his position. Parenti decided to become an independent author, lecturer, and activist, and has taught in the U.S. and abroad. This rebroadcast is a tribute to Michael Parenti and part of a very popular and ever-expanding series drawn from what Parenti called real history, a thought-provoking reading of a large number of all too familiar stories. If current affairs will allow it, I'm planning on bringing you more recordings from the archives that I recorded and collected since 1992 at Michael Parenti's appearances in the Bay Area and at events in other states. Now, in 2025, Michael Parenti is still alive at the age of 91, but he has retired from writing and public speaking. Sadly, he has dementia and is in the care of his family on the East Coast. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, TUCRadio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. Downloads are free, and we appreciate any size donation to keep TUC Radio on the air. Our email address is tuc@tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.